A key part of any great commissioned course is case studies. One of the best ways of learning is by learning from example. We learn by doing and we learn from the examples of others. And so we want to feed our hearts and our minds with examples of excellence. And one of the excellent examples we need to remember is William Carey, the father of modern missions. Have you ever heard this sort of reaction? It's impossible. It can't be done. Don't be ridiculous. What difference can one person make? Have anyone say things like that to you? If you've ever encountered any of those kind of reactions, you must know anyone who embarks on a challenging enterprise, especially those determined to end legal abortions or eradicate pornography or establish a Christian school or a Christian teacher training college or stop the slave trade or work for national reformation revival or evangelize a Muslim nation, any of those people will encounter those people who seem to believe they've got a gift of discouragement and a gift of criticism. A ministry of discouragement and a gift of criticism. Now, should Christians be involved in politics? There are those who maintain that Christians shouldn't even be involved in social and political issues at all. We get criticism for being involved in some of these social and political concerns. When you tell them about the abortion holocaust or the pornography plague, they mutter, all we can do is pray, or just preach the gospel, or it's a sign of the last days. Have you heard those kind of reactions? We suspect that such attitudes are often motivated more by laziness and cowardice or a selfish desire to shirk responsibility and hard work than anything else. Certainly those people who resort to such superficial excuses are being disobedient to the clear commands of Scripture. Love your neighbor as yourself. Go and do likewise, Jesus said. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Rescue those being led away to death. Make disciples of all nations. Anyone who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. So in the light of such scriptures, how can people come up with, just pray, just preach the gospel, don't get involved in social political issues, sign of the end times? Those who maintain that Christians shouldn't be involved in social or political issues display their ignorance of both the Bible and of church history. Over 70% of the Bible deals with social, political and national issues. Abraham used military force to rescue Lot and his family from the four kings in Genesis 14. God raised up Joseph to be prime minister of Egypt. Samuel, Nathan, Elisha, Isaiah, Ezra, in fact almost all the prophets were heavily involved in politics as advisors to kings and exerting a godly influence on national affairs. Moses, Elijah, Jeremiah, John the Baptist publicly confronted and rebuked wicked rulers. King David was described as a man after God's own heart. He was a soldier, and he was a king. Daniel and Mordecai became prime ministers in pagan Babylonian and Persian governments, yet without compromise. God raised up Deborah and Queen Esther to national leadership. Joshua, Gideon, Nehemiah held senior political positions. Now, I'm not advocating getting involved in party politics. In fact, the Constitution of Frontline Fellowship forbids any member of our mission in getting involved in party politics. But not being involved in a party political position isn't the same thing as not getting involved in political and social issues and speaking to it from a biblical point of view. We don't say that Christians can't get involved in politics. Christians must. But I don't believe it's good to mix missions with party politics, in that it would be a conflict of interest if a member of our mission, as in a leadership of this mission, was also a candidate for a political party or something like that. That, to me, would be a conflict, because this is full-time, overtime work. I don't think you can easily stretch it. But we need other Christians called to politics. We will speak to the issues, but none of us are interested in running for office or anything like that. And I've had people approaching me, asking me if I'd be willing to run for political office, and no, I'm not. I'm convinced the pen is mightier than the sword, and I will continue to utilize our weapons through the PowerPoints, through the films, through the radio, through newsletters, through magazines, through books, through seminars, leadership training, preaching and proclaiming. I think we can influence political things in a positive direction from the outside, but others need to be on the inside. We just don't believe in doing it ourselves. Ezekiel 22 verse 30, I looked for a man among them who would stand before me, and build up the wall, stand in the gap on behalf of the land so they would not have to destroy it. Those who maintain that Christians should not be involved in political and social issues are not only ignoring the word of God, but they're showing the ignorance of church history. Before the advent of Christianity, every culture practiced slavery. Every culture practiced human sacrifice. In the Roman Empire, abortion, infanticide, the abandonment of unwanted babies was legal and commonplace. The Aztec Empire in Mexico, the Inca Empire in Peru, and the Mayan Empire in Central America engaged in slavery, ritual rapes, mass human sacrifices. Slaves were marched up the stairs of the pyramid-type temples. At the top, a priest would rip out the beating hearts one by one. There were over 80,000 human skulls on the skull racks of just one of Montezuma's many temples. Only the advent of Christianity introduced a respect for the sanctity of life and ended the rampant infanticide and human sacrifice. In the same way, slavery was eradicated as a result of the tireless efforts of Christians like William Wilberforce and David Livingstone. The whole concept of charity was a Christian innovation, as were hospitals, hence the healing symbol of a cross. But of course, these monumental achievements were not easily achieved. Every victory for life and liberty was only accomplished by much sacrifice and much ingenuity over many years, many, many years of lots of hard work. If you sometimes feel overwhelmed by the immensity of the task before you, or if you feel discouraged by the seemingly never-ending series of obstacles and opposition, the frustrations and the failures, take heart. The man whom God used to launch the modern missionary movement faced all of this and much, much more. Undereducated. In fact, he didn't even finish primary school. Underfunded. He was launched with £13. Underestimated. Nobody expected anything good to come of this cobbler from the rural areas of England. William Carey seemed to have everything against him. He was brought up in abject poverty. He never had the benefit of high school. He had a thirst for knowledge, though. He read widely, and he had a keen interest in nature. As he was working on repairing shoes, he had a map of the world next to him, and he was praying for the nations of the world. Carey's formal education ended in junior school, but by age 12, he had taught himself Latin. Then he went on to master on his own Hebrew, Greek, French, and Dutch. He eventually became professor of Bengali, Sanskrit, and Marathi at the prestigious Fort William College in Calcutta, where the civil servants were trained for the British India. Carey and his co-workers, William Warden, Joshua, and Hannah Marshman, started over 100 Christian schools for over 8,000 Indian children of all castes, and he launched the first Christian college in Asia at Serampore. This college continues to this day. Carey finally succeeded in translating the Bible into 6 languages and New Testaments and Gospels into 29 other languages. Carey's achievements are all the more amazing when you consider that his bold project to plant the gospel amongst the Hindus in India was completely illegal. By an act of British Parliament, it was illegal for any missionary to work in India. For the first 20 years, Carey's mission to India had to be carried out with ingenuity and circumspection. Based under Danish protection, a small Danish colony of Serampore, because the British wouldn't allow him to do their work from their territory. At last, the British Parliament, under pressure from the evangelical members of Parliament like William Wilberforce, reversed the policy and compelled the British East India Company to allow missionaries in India. See, for years, the British East India Company said no missionaries because they knew if the missionaries succeed, it's going to undermine their business. It's because if the missionaries get the people converted, it's going to create a backlash from the Hindus, it'll create upset, and maybe they'll be standing up against some of their corrupt policies. So I know that it's common propaganda of the communists, the missionaries and the colonials work together and the businessmen were all one big conspiracy, but that's not fact. In fact, the missionaries are continually in conflict with the colonial authorities. The colonial authorities are continually trying to stop them, as is proved by that true story that you saw beyond the next mountain. How this missionary from Wales was actually kicked back by the British. They didn't want the missionaries in these areas. They felt they were undermining the stability and peace of the situation. In many cases, the missionaries operated without any support and against the laws of the authorities. And frequently, they came to conflict with the commercial enterprise, like the British East India Company. And the British East India Company was very hostile to the missionaries. So again, I know it makes a nice bit of propaganda for the communists to say it all worked together, but in fact, there was a lot of conflict. Sometimes Carey's students saw him in tears while he was teaching them geography. Carey would point to various places on the map and cry, and these are pagans, pagans. William Carey was considered a radical in his day. He boycotted sugar because he was so intensely opposed to slavery. And sugar came from the West Indies, produced with slave labor. So he wouldn't take sugar with his tea. This was considered pretty radical. He also took the extremely unpopular stand of supporting the American War of Independence against Britain. Now imagine, he was British, he's in Britain, he's an Englishman. And at that time when America was at war with Britain, he supported the American colonists and said, but they're right. Parliament is not giving them the chartered rights of the Magna Carta. They deserve to be ruled under the Magna Carta, and yet their chartered rights as Englishmen are being violated. Parliament's in the wrong, the English colonists are in the right. This did not make him popular in the middle of a war to be supporting the other side. He was also subjected to vicious criticism and gossip under the extreme heat and in abject poverty. Initially, for his first few years, he was having daily dangers with snakes, crocodiles, tigers in a remote and mosquito-ridden jungle house, and his wife Dorothy went insane. She never was a very strong character to start with, and the conditions in India were so bad, she was restrained with chains for the last 14 years of her life. She literally was ranting and raving about the imaginary unfaithfulness of her husband. She attacked him several occasions with a knife. She is diagnosed by the doctors as insane, had to be physically restrained for the last 12 years of her life. She was a very weak person. She wasn't even literate. I mean, here you've got this genius of a husband. She signed her wedding register with an X. She couldn't even sign her own name. I mean, that's how illiterate she was. The Careys also lost their 5-year-old son, Peter, who died of dysentery in 1794. That's a year after they arrived. Every family member suffered from malaria, dysentery, other tropical diseases frequently. Carey's first co-worker, John Thomas, squandered all their money and bankrupted the mission, forcing William to work on a plantation to provide for his malnourished family. They were literally starving. And in their first 7 months in India, the Careys had to move house 5 times, each to a progressively cheaper and worse accommodation for lack of funds. Although Carey wrote home to family and mission frequently, it was 17 months before they received the first letters from home. And one of the first letters was from the Mission Society, criticizing Carey for being swallowed up in the pursuits of merchant. Now they're not supporting him. He's having to work as well, economically, to just sustain his family. And they're criticizing him in the first letter for getting involved in merchant work. Somehow, while often sick, holding down a full-time secular job, surrounded by domestic turmoil, with an insane wife literally screaming from the next room, Carey mastered Bengali and Sanskrit, and by 1797, that's within 4 years, the New Testament was translated into Bengali and ready for printing. Carey had also established several schools at the same time. He was preaching regularly in Bengali. However, after 7 years of tireless toil in India, Carey still didn't have a single convert to show for it. How did William Carey manage to maintain such a productive schedule while having to endure all these crushing disappointments, the endless distractions, the undeserved criticisms, the physical ailments, the heartbreaking tragedies? How did he manage to persevere and keep on keeping on without even the encouragement of a single convert to justify his effort and sacrifice? To understand what motivated this most remarkable man, we need to go back and look at what inspired him in the first place. He had a vision of victory. One of the most influential sermons preached in world history was preached on the 31st of May, 1792, by William Carey in Northampton, England. You could say it's a sermon that launched the modern missionary movement. Carey's sermon literally sparked the greatest century of Christian advance. The 19th century is the greatest advance that Christianity ever made in any one century. It marked the entry of the English-speaking world into missions. Since that time, in the last 200 odd years, English speakers have made up 80%, actually it's more like 85%, of all Protestant mission workforce worldwide. That is remarkable. Because before this, the English speakers were not the main missionaries in the world. And now, even to this day, despite strenuous attempts to do otherwise, the English speakers still dominate the missions workforce. The text of his historic sermon was Isaiah 54, verse 2 to 3. Enlarge the place of your tent. Let them stretch out the curtains of your dwellings. Do not spare. Lengthen your cords. Strengthen your stakes. For you shall expand to the right and to the left. And your descendants will inherit the nations and make desolate cities inhabited. The theme of his sermon is summed up in the famous quote, expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. Yet, riveting as the sermon was, and that's what people who listened to it said, the result was initially indecision. It was just too radical. Carey was considered an enthusiast, which meant a fanatic. He was an embarrassment because he had a bee in his bonnet about missions. The people were considering the idea of missions across the seas as absolutely lunatic. But Carey persisted until 5 months later, 12 Reformed Baptist ministers formed the particular Calvinist Baptist Society for the propagating of the gospel among the heathens. That was the name. I've heard people say he started the Baptist Missionary Society. Well, that's not what they called it. Later changed its name to that, but that was the first name. And the first collection from these pastors amounted to £13, 2 shillings and sixpence. And with that, they launched the modern missionary movement. I was at a missions conference in England last year, and I saw we were only a few miles from Kettering, and I said to my host, we're close to Kettering. And I said, what's at Kettering? Said, well, that's where Carey launched the modern missionary movement. I want to get to that. Oh, really? So it took us then. And also, just a few miles, we were only about 14 miles from Lutterworth. And I said, Lutterworth, we must get to Lutterworth. What's at Lutterworth? My host asked. So, well, that's where Professor John Wycliffe translated the Bible to English and launched the Lollards. And I, oh, really? So it takes an African visitor to teach English about their own heritage around them. It's quite amazing. In this house, Carey House, this is where they launched the modern missionary movement, where they took the first offering of £13 and 2 shillings and launched the particular Calvinist Baptist Missionary Society for the propagating of the gospel among the heathen. What inspired Carey's landmark book, and here's the cover, this is the actual title, a 42-word title, not a snappy, quick title, An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens, in which a religious state of the different nations of the world, the success of former undertakings, and the practicality of further undertakings are considered. That's William Carey's title of the book that launched the modern missionary movement. This prototype missionary society was motivated by his eschatology of victory. William Carey was a post-millennialist. He believed that the God who commanded his church to make disciples of all nations would ensure that the Great Commission would ultimately be fulfilled. The work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country with the knowledge of Christ. We are neither working at uncertainty, nor are we afraid of the result. Christ must reign until Satan has not one inch of territory. Time and again, in the face of crushing defeats and disasters and disappointments and diseases, Carey reiterated his unwaveringly optimistic view of the end times. Though the superstitions of the heathen were 1,000 times stronger than they are, though the example of the Europeans be 1,000 times worse, though I were deserted by all and persecuted by all, yet my faith fixed in that sure word would rise above all obstructions and would overcome every trial. God's cause will triumph. And Carey's faith was most certainly vindicated. The years of hard work and a wholehearted sacrifice were graciously rewarded by God. Carey's ministry literally transformed India. When Carey stepped ashore at Calcutta on 11th of November 1793, India was in a terribly degraded state. If an infant was sick, it was assumed he was under the influence of an evil spirit. The custom was to expose sick infants to the elements, perhaps hang them in a basket, leaving them out all night, leaving them out all day. Near Melba, Kerry found the remains of a baby who had been offered as a sacrifice to be eaten alive by white ants. At the Sagamela, where the Ganges River flows in the sea, Kerry witnessed how mothers threw their babies into the sea to drown or to be devoured by crocodiles. This, the Hindus regarded as a holy sacrifice to the mother Ganges. Kerry undertook a thorough research into the numbers, the nature, the reasons for these infanticide, and he published his reports. He presented several petitions to the government until in 1802 infanticide was outlawed, and that marked the first time that the British government interfered directly in the religious practices of India. They fought against it all the way. You know, we mustn't get involved in internal religious affairs. But Kerry compelled them to do so. It set a precedent for the abolition of other practices. Hinduism had an extremely low view of women. It was often stated, in Hinduism, there's no salvation for a woman unless she's been reborn, reincarnated as a man. Her only hope lay in serving men in complete subjection, so that she might be reincarnated in a future life as a man. Many female babies were smothered, strangled, or drowned at birth. Girls were married as young as 4 years old. Widows were perceived as bad omens, who had brought about the death of their husbands. Widows were seen as an economic liability. Women didn't inherit anything. Bereaved widows had to shave off all their hair, remove all jewelry, they were forbidden to remarry, but they were required to cohabit with the deceased husband's nearest male relative. Tremendous pressure was exerted on widows to submit to sukti, or immolation, to be burned alive on the funeral pyre of the husband. And amongst the weaver or the kauris caste, widows were buried alive. So because of the Hindu practice of sati, children who just lost their father would now lose their mother as well and be orphaned. The cruelty of this practice is unbelievable. And the Hindu practice of polygamy compounded the problem. William Kerry documented cases where on one occasion 33 wives of one man was burned alive on his funeral pyre. 33 wives of one man burned alive at one time. On another occasion, there was an 11-year-old widow, 11 years old, burned alive on the funeral pyre of her husband. Lepers were rejected by the family. Society burned lepers alive, believing that this would guarantee a better reincarnation in the next life. Hindus taught that only a violent and fiery end could purify the body and ensure transmigration into a healthy new existence. So euthanasia was also widely practiced by those afflicted with other diseases. The infirmed were regularly carried to be left exposed to heat and cold, or to be eaten by crocodiles on the side of the river, or by insects. Kerry fought against these and many other evils, including child prostitution, slavery, the caste system. He publicly criticized the government for inaction and passivity in the face of murder. He accused the British Raj government of being accessories to murder in not enforcing biblical principles to enforce. And the British government were having the principle of so many people to don't get involved, they've got their own religion, they're sincere, they're happy the way they are. All this nonsense that we hear again today. But as Kerry said, you're accessories to murder. You're standing by and doing nothing. What would we say to our society today as we stand by while there's abortion being done with taxpayers' money? Legally. Kerry publicly criticized the government for inaction and passivity, and he organized public debates. He spoke and wrote against these atrocities often. At first he met with an official indifference. But in 1805, the Indian Supreme Court ruled that sati had religious sanction, therefore couldn't be questioned. So they pushed his objections out of court. William Kerry became a pioneer for freedom. He published and established the first newspaper ever printed in an Oriental or Eastern language, the Samachar Darpan, an English language newspaper, Friends of India, which continues to this day. Kerry pioneered mass communication in India. He launched the social reform movement, which he believed that above all forms of truth and faith, Christianity seeks free discussion. No other religion can say this, that it seeks and encourages free discussion of all issues. William Kerry was the first man to stand up against the brutal murders and widespread oppression of women through female infanticide, the child marriage, polygamy, enforced female illiteracy, widow burning, and forced euthanasia. He conducted systematic research. He published his writings to raise protests in both Bengal and in England. He educated and influenced a whole generation of civil servants through his lectures at Fort William College, which was the British government's main place of training. Carey fought against the idea that a widow's life ceases to be valuable after the death of her husband. He undermined the oppression and the exploitation of women by providing women with education. He opened the first schools for girls. Education was a major emphasis of his mission. In 1800, Carey was invited to lecture on Bengali, Sanskrit and Marathi. He was the best Oriental language expert at Fort William College, which was the prestigious English college for civil servants in India. In 1806, he was made a professor. Not bad for someone who hadn't finished primary school. The professor of Oriental language in the most prestigious college in Asia. In 1818, he and his colleges launched Serampore College, which taught theology, botany, zoology, Sanskrit, Arabic, and English literature. And it continues to this day. But it was Carey's relentless battle against Shruti for 25 years, which finally led to the famous edict in 1829, which banned widow burning. And this is the culmination of half a lifetime's struggle. Carey was the first man who led the campaign for a humane treatment for leprosy, and he ended the practice of burning lepers alive. Carey had a comprehensive view of the Great Commission. He ministered to spirit, mind, and body. He introduced the idea of savings banks to India to make investment, industry, commerce, economic development possible. He founded the Agricultural Horticultural Society in the 1820s. 30 years before the Royal Agricultural Society was established in England. He wasn't just a trendsetter in Asia, he was ahead of things even in England. He introduced the steam engine to in India. He pioneered the idea of lending libraries. He persuaded his friends in England to ship out tons of books to regenerate and to reform England. Carey also introduced the study of astronomy into India. He saw that the prevalent astrology, you know, reading the stars for my horoscope, with its fatalism and its superstitious fears and inability to manage time, had terribly destructive consequences. Hinduism's astrology makes us subjects, victims of the stars, with our lives determined by the stars. But the Christian science of astronomy sets us free to be rulers, to devise calendars, to identify directions, to study geography, to plan better our lives and our work. Carey was the first man in India to write essays on forestry. 50 years before the government made its first attempts at forest conservation, Carey was already practicing forest conservation, planting and cultivating timber. He understood that God has made man responsible for the earth. Carey was a botanist who cultivated beautiful gardens like the Serampore Gardens and the Calcutta Botanical Gardens. He frequently lectured on science, botany and zoology, because he believed all thy works praise thee, O Lord. So he knew nature was worthy of study. Carey pointed out that even insects are worthy of attention. They're not souls in bondage, as Hinduism taught through reincarnation, but they're creatures with a God-given purpose. Carey was also the father of modern print technology in India. He introduced modern science of printing, and he built what was then the largest printing press in India. He devised the fonts in Asiatic languages which had never before had printed languages. In 1812, a devastating fire destroyed Carey's warehouse and his printing presses, his paper stock, his manuscripts, representing many years of work. It was absolutely tragic. He was lecturing at Calcutta at the Fort William College when the fire took place, and they put the fire out, and then some Indians, seeking to be helpful, were opening the windows to clear the smoke out. But what happens when you open windows and there's been a fire? More oxygen comes in, it reignited the smoldering embers, and the flames just burst up and this time took everything out. They had literally put the fire out when the introduction of new oxygen by all the opening of windows created a new fire. Something for us to remember. Even in the face of this catastrophe of 1812, Carey praised God that no lives had been lost, and he quoted Psalm 46. Be still and know that the Lord is God. He resolved to do better translations than the ones that were now ashes, and he consoled himself that every branch that he prunes bears fruit, and every branch that is pruned more, it's brought forth more fruit. The Lord has laid me low, he said, that I might look more simply to him. However vexing it may be, a road travelled the second time is usually taken with more confidence and ease than the first. He quoted Isaiah 61. He trusted God for better printing presses, more accurate translations, a phoenix rising out of the ashes, and that's what happened. Not only was Kerry hit by the fire, but deaths in each one of the seven missionary families at Tsarampo in 1812. Kerry himself just buried a grandson. He had to endure unjust criticism, unbalanced criticisms from young new missionaries who actually split from the Tsarampo mission. There were slanderous accusations from the mission side in England, as well as an earthquake and a flood. One of his sons, Felix, also caused much embarrassment when he backslid, adopted a lavish lifestyle, began drinking heavily. He actually became British ambassador to Burma. But ultimately, Felix came back to the Lord and became fully committed to the mission. Yet, despite all these controversies, calamities, conflicts, William Carey's monumental achievements outshine all of his critics. He was a dedicated Christian who God used in the most extraordinary ways to launch the greatest century of missionary advance, to translate the scriptures into more languages than any other translator in history, and to save literally millions of lives by his compassionate social action and by his tireless labors. He excelled as a missionary strategist. He was humble, he was hardworking, he was industrious and persistent, persevering for over 41 years without any furlough in the field. Once when Kerry was asked what the secret of his success was, he said, "I can plod. I owe anything I've achieved to plodding." He didn't see himself as brilliant, but he just was persistent, like the tortoise who beats the hare, because the hare keeps stopping. But as a tortoise, he kept going. We need to follow his example by ministering to spirit, mind, and body, by persevering through all disappointments and opposition, with an unshakable faith in a sovereign God. Any questions at all from anyone? William Kerry, Father of Modern Missions. That's a good question. Actually, there's a book out on the three Mrs. Careys, because two of his wives died and preceded him. So he has actually married three times. Once to a very intelligent Danish noble woman who unfortunately died very young, but she was his intellectual equal, but unfortunately the first wife was, you don't know what he was thinking. And she was so weak, she didn't want to go in the field. So she wants to stay in England. So he determined to go to the field with his older son and to leave his wife and other children behind. And the ship was caught in a storm, had to come back to port, and by then she changed her mind, she decided to join him. How different might things have been if she had stayed? You know, travel at that stage, you didn't have planes, you had these wooden ships. It took him 6 months to reach the field by ship, coming around the Cape of Good Hope, stopped here. By the way, when he stopped at Cape Town, he said, "We must have the world's first missions conference here in Cape Town." William Kerry looked at the Table Mountain, he said, "This is the ends of the earth. We must get missionaries from all over the world together here." And he wanted in 1810 to have the world's first missions conference here in Cape Town. He is 100 years ahead of his time. The first world missions conference was held in Edinburgh in 1910. But Kerry had the idea first. He was way ahead. So his home life doesn't seem to be a brilliant example. But that was not unusual for Englishmen at that stage to have the view that duty comes first. And they didn't have a high view of their duty to family before James Dobson was publishing Folks in the Family. And I don't look at these men as examples of how to be a good father, but I do see them for examples in dedication in the mission field. So there's not one example we'll look at that's a perfect example in everything. Obviously, all God's people have their failings. And I think William Kerry was a failure as a husband and a father. He was a great success as a Bible translator and a missionary and a social pioneer. And we need to recognize that. It's not all positives, obviously. So, no, his wife, I mean, he loved her and served her when she was ranting and raving and being a lunatic, but basically she should never have gone to field. She was too soft and her constitution was unbalanced going into India. And if you think of what was also mentioned in the lectures on spiritual warfare, some people are more susceptible to the influence of evil spirits, And India at that time was replete with it, with all the polygamy, polytheism, idolatry. You can just imagine how much demonic force were raging and the spiritual warfare being waged against this first mission. So Kerry paid a great price. Dorothy paid a great price. The children paid a great price. I mean, the boys were basically running rampant and lunatics, you know, going wild, while Kerry was able to somehow focus on his Bible translation while there's pandemonium around him. And only once Hannah Marshman came, she started the schools and she took the Kerry children under her wings and she started to raise them properly. This other lady who had her own children anyway. But until someone else stepped into the gap, Kerry's children were basically bringing themselves up. It was wild.
And also, when Nan died, the ladies who birthed, what happened if one of the wives died?
No problem. You can have lots of wives. That's polygamy. No, seriously, I mean, the view of women was very, very low. They didn't have a Christian view of chivalry. They didn't have respect for women. They didn't have a sense of protection. And to have such young, I mean, arranged marriages, 4-year-olds and burning 11-year-old widows, honestly, how can any culture be that depraved? And this is the problem. We had the 1999 Parliament of World Religions down the road here in Cape Town, the Good Hope Center. And the Dalai Lama and everyone else was there. Well, at one of these workshops, some Indian Hindu professor was saying, there's no such thing as right and wrong. Everything is right culture. And it's wrong for missionaries. Now, nothing's wrong, but it's wrong for missionaries to go into cultures and interfere in the local cultures and practices and to impose their standards on others. We must never interfere in local cultures or tell them what's right and wrong. So one of our missionaries from Frontline raised his hand and said, excuse me, was the English missionary William Kerry wrong for opposing widow burning in India? Well, there was a lot of stumbling, spluttering, and in the end, you'll never believe what the guy's answer was. He said, well, widow burning didn't affect that many people. That was the only answer. Oh, only a few 100,000 women burned and a few million children orphaned. This doesn't matter. It's not that many. I mean, the callousness of that response. No, not every widow was burned on a funeral pyre, but hundreds of thousands were. And to think the man could, that's the best response he could. He couldn't bring himself to say William Kerry was right. Even though, as you saw, the Indian government has printed 6-rupee stamps honoring William Kerry and on the 200th anniversary of his coming to India, 1993. Yes, yes. No, he didn't. He never named his church. After he died, people were so proud of his name that they named. No, he wouldn't name the church William Kerry Baptist Church. But they're so proud that Kerry was there at that church. It's understandable why today they call it the Kerry Baptist Church. No, he was a humble man. He wouldn't have done that. Yes.
He was a very humble person. Don't you think that he was quite extreme?
Refused what?
The use of sugar, because it was.
Slave labor produced it. Well,
I asked this question.
I don't think it's that extreme. I think that's the principal stand that he made.
I asked this question because I'm a little bit aware of what goes on in China today. We get lots of cheap products from China.
Yes.
Essentially because there is free state labor that produces this in many cases. And
slave labor.
A lot of Western companies, outsource production
yes.
to China because they can get labor at low cost.
Oh, what very low cost.
What even makes it worse is the fact that many of those who provide that labor are Christian prisoners.
Yes.
So the question comes, if Kerry could adopt such a posture, there are lots of Chinese products that we consume today. What should be the Christian's response?
I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's a very relevant application. If William Kerry refused to use sugar, which at that stage came primarily from slave labor in the West Indies, How should we as Christians in the 21st century respond to these very cheap products from China, much of which is produced by slave labor, many of the slaves of whom are Christian brothers and sisters in China? I certainly have tried for many, many years, for the 15 or 16 odd years or more that I've been aware of this, to avoid buying made in Red China products. And I think it's a good practice, and it's hard sometimes to find products that aren't made in China. They dominate the toy market and a lot of other things like that. But it's wrong. And China is using this wealth to oppress the Christians, to expand its military, to threaten us in the West. And why should we as Christians be supporting slavery today by buying those products? I think there should be a concerted Christian attempt to, wherever possible, and as our knowledge is, as we're informed about this knowledge, surely we should stop supporting slave products in China. Thank you. That's a good point. Any other comments before we break for lunch? Who would like to close in prayer for us, please? Thank you.
Precious Father, we thank you for the way you've been with us, for the time we spent this morning. Thank you.